start by doing what's necessary, then you'll be doing what's possible. And pretty soon you'll be doing the impossible. Yeah. And there's lots of things in life that might seem impossible, but they're not. But you have to start somewhere.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. This week, I spoke with Frank McCourt Jr., the former CEO of McCourt Global and, of course, former owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers. We talked about his business success and past history, but what he is doing now in the world of digital privacy and autonomy is incredible, and it could be the savior for our society and for social media addiction. McCourt founded Project Liberty, a groundbreaking endeavor dedicated to safeguarding individuals' information on the web. Project Liberty aims to empower users with greater control over their digital footprint, ensuring their data remains private and secure in an increasingly interconnected world. If he can make this work, we will all owe him. Of course, with my first question, I had to take it back to Boston, where I went to school, and I asked him what it was like growing up in Beantown and what he learned there that he still carries with him today.
Yeah, it's good to be with you too, Robert. And yeah, I like your question because I think a lot of what I'm doing now in life is built off of the that was formed in my years in Boston and growing up in Watertown and being part of a large Irish Catholic family and one of seven kids. And just you can picture the dinner table, right? Nine of us at least at the dinner table, and we'd always have people dropping by or we'd invite friends over, or my parents might have somebody join us. So you have a dozen people at the dinner table every night. It's a bit like an unruly board meeting, right? So it was great. It's a great experience. Obviously, I learned a lot in school and informally, but I learned a lot at my dinner table, I can assure you of that. And I have siblings and that are liberal. I have siblings that are conservative. And I heard a lot of different perspectives on things, which I thought was an extremely healthy and helpful way to grow up. And like all kids, we were pretty good at identifying problems. And so we were as good at complaining about things as anyone. But dinner would never end without my mom saying, okay, that's great. You all figured out the problem. So now what are you going to do about it? And that stuck with me for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. It sounds like your mom really understood that there's so many people who talk and who go over and over, but it seems like you really took from her, or she really gave to all of you, the fact that, you know what, that's great. And you talked about this, discussed it, but it sounds like she really knew that you have to work, you have to put this into action. Did you feel that way?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And it's both my mom and dad modeled tremendous behavior. And it was what I would call a traditional family. My dad went out and worked every day, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom raising us. And my dad taught me how to be a man and have character. And my word mattered, my handshake mattered, and do the right thing and be ethical and morally correct. And your reputation, your character, everything. And my mom taught me and my siblings how to love, right? How to feel and empathize with other people and really learn from them and be respectful towards them and so forth. So that combination of learning how to think and act and learning how to love and feel it was a great combination. I feel extremely fortunate to have had that behavior modeled through my developmental years. I would add though, Robert, I think many people remember the experiences at their dinner table and growing up with their parents and what they learned. And I don't feel that, although I obviously my experience was unique to me and I feel blessed to have had it, I really think that many millions of people have had a similar experience growing up. And I think that we should all reflect on that and embrace what our parents gave us and understand our obligation now as parents to our kids is really important. And I dare say it was a simpler world I grew up in. And the lessons, oftentimes I made mistakes just like everyone else, but I think the mistakes I made, I could recover from. I'm not so sure when kids make mistakes in this day and age, it's quite so easy to recover because everything is documented now on a device that people are carrying around with them, and it never goes away. It can be brought out to attack or hurt or bully or harm another human being at any point in the future. And I think we see that chaos playing out in the world right now, right? Where the technology is dividing us, not joining us. And it's, of course, there's some good things that come from technology, but it shouldn't be there are some good things offset by some bad things. There should be mostly good things, and we should minimize the bad things, and we shouldn't have a technology design that is inherently harmful.
Yeah, we know, and many people listening to this podcast, is there's lots of entrepreneurs know your success in terms of business and things you've done, whether it be in construction or real estate or sports. What I want to talk about, and what I think is really, especially as you just mentioned, having children of my own today in 13 and 15, and seeing how different it is from when we grew up, and you learned everything from friends or at the dinner table. But you have started an organization. I want you to talk about it, because when you first told me about it and I heard about it, to me, it seemed like, wow, this is an impossible task. And I love it because I see the effects. But can you talk about Project Liberty?
Yeah, happy to. And I want to key initially into your word, impossible. Francis of Assisi said something like the following: start by doing what's necessary, then you'll be doing what's possible, and pretty soon you'll be doing the impossible. Okay. And there's lots of things in life that might seem impossible, but they're not. But you have to start somewhere. And that's what we've done with Project Liberty. We started this back in December of 19, and we started doing what was necessary. And now we're doing what's possible. And pretty soon, I believe, we'll be doing the impossible. And that is changing how the internet works. And in getting to a point where we as parents know that we're protecting our kids, and we're not torn between this Hobson's choice of keep them off of social media and have them be ostracized by their friends, or put them on social media and hope for the best. And because we know what a toxic landscape they're stepping into, and we've learned how insidious this technology is, and how it's actually designed to addict people, not just kids. But adults are harmed by this as well. But boy, all of us as kids made mistakes. But to make a mistake and never be able to recover from it, that's pretty daunting, right, for kids. So yeah, Project Liberty I've committed $500 million to it to fix the technology. But also, I look at it as not even a technology project. I see it as a social project or a political project, because we need to get people awakened here, understanding the problem, understanding it doesn't have to be this way, build tech that is an alternative to the current internet, and of course, create a commercial ecosystem where people can build things and are incentivized to do so and are excited to do so, because they can innovate and create wealth and build businesses and so on and so forth. So it's a three-track project. It has tech that sits in a 501c3 in a foundation, along with all of our academic and other partners who are doing the research and are experts in policy and governance and so forth. Yeah, and then these other two tracks, one which is really where we're building a global alliance of people who are concerned about the problem and want to lean into it and help solve it. And then, as I mentioned, the commercial ecosystem. And I mentioned that $500 million, never in my dreams as a kid did I think I would have that, you know, those kind of resources to dedicate to something like this. And I'm actually feel privileged to be able to do it. But I want to be really clear. This is much bigger than anything I could do alone. And this needs lots of people involved and engaged, some financially, I hope, but others bringing their other gifts forward in terms of their technical talents or their ability to mobilize people, or quite frankly, young people that have ideas that go build in this new world and build the new big companies of the future. We're at a fork in the road here. We know that the architecture of this technology is really destroying everything we love. And we shouldn't be giving up, you know, our human and and what we care about and putting our kids in harm's way and just so we can use the internet. That's a crazy trade-off, right? So we need an internet that actually protects our kids, makes our democracy stronger. We can build great businesses, share in the wealth that's created in a way that it just doesn't all land in the laps of five big companies. And I say that as a capitalist, by the way. I'm all for making money and people making money. And my family's been in business for over 130 years as builders, as you point out. And I'm proud of that. But at some point, enough is enough. Okay, we're not going to, this is not a game. Life is not a game where a few companies get to destroy democracy and harm kids and make all the money. And, you know, this is real life. People are being hurt and harmed. And we now know that this technology is addicting. It is harming kids. People have had a chance to fix it and they didn't. When we see all the stuff about Zuckerberg and Facebook and where people telling them, hey, this is harming kids. And instead of fixing it, it was like, carry on. I want to do it anyway. And that's wrong. And it needs to be called out as wrong. And we need to just band together to change this, because I certainly am not going to be able to do it by myself.
Yeah, I, as a parent and just someone who wants to see or has seen the effects of social media on mental health and society in general, and just this world, you could talk about elections or whatever it might be, am very keen. And I think it's one of, if not the most important things today. I want to ask you, what was it that personally drove you to really take on this initiative and make this, and we'll talk about your book coming out, but what was it that you said, this is what I want to do now? This is what I want to build.
For me, it's been a journey. And there were several points along the journey that really made it very clear to me that this was my work, at least for the next decade. The first, we already talked about. I grew up in a great home, great parents, siblings, and I'm hardwired based on that. And meaning when you see a problem, you have an obligation to try to fix it. And you can't unsee it or sit and just keep complaining about it. Right? I already mentioned that. Secondly, I come from a family of builders that for five generations, we've been building things. My great grandfather started building roads when Henry Ford started building cars. And we've had the great privilege of building projects all over this great country and beyond, and big projects, important projects, and infrastructure projects, and as well as other real estate projects. And we all have skills that we've learned either at our mom or dad's knee or at the knee of some expert or in school or by experience or whatever. For me, I've been fortunate to be around the building business since I was a young child, literally. I used to love going to work on Saturdays with my dad, and you know, he'd toss me up on a bulldozer or a front-end loader or a big truck or a crane or something with the operator of that equipment. And I was in seventh heaven, right, sitting there and watching how that worked, and then ultimately learning how to operate these things myself when I got a bit older. So it's in my blood, for sure. And I mention that because we have an infrastructure problem here, Robert, and we can fix this. So the internet was never designed to do what it's doing right now and how it's being used. So we need to go back to the bottom of the stack and fix it. And we can talk about that in a minute. The next stop on my journey was LA. And I had the privilege of owning the Los Angeles Dodgers, and it was a, and had a great run there in LA until, unfortunately, I got divorced and went through what was the most difficult period of my life. And because not only was it a personal tragedy when a family is broken apart, like ours was, but to have it happen publicly and in a place like LA, which personalities and all that are, that's part of what happens in LA. That's part of the LA landscape, and it's, you know, part of what you sign up for. And so it was a tough period and was humiliating and so on and so forth. But it was also where I learned what it felt like to be on the receiving end of social media. And this was end of 2009 through early 2012. Facebook was five, six, seven, 8 years old. The Apple had introduced their iPhone. Mobile was taking over the world. And so the combination of mobile devices, social media, and people being able to say whatever the heck they wanted to, you know, on social media and bully or attack or malign people. And the people on the receiving end, you know, as we've learned now over the last decade or so, there's very little they can do about it, right? They're helpless. And certainly back then, that's what I felt, was a feeling of helplessness. And I think it just gives me some, that experience gives me a little bit of more awareness and understanding of the set of issues than I would have had I not had the experience. And it was just something I was reading about, that others were having these experiences. But I know millions of people now are impacted by this. And by the way, it's not just the people who are directly attacked on social media. And by the way, now feel like they have to defend themselves and push back, which requires the person who initiated it to push back, which requires the receiving person to push. It's an endless triggering device. And now we learn that's exactly what it's designed to do, which is why we're in this constant state of arguing with each other in America and in other places where this technology is used. So that is not a good thing. And it's tearing us apart. Not only are families being torn apart because of what the harms to kids, but we're seeing society being ripped apart because everybody's had a Thanksgiving dinner experience. Now you can't talk about certain things because of political extremism or whatever the case may be. And then you don't have to do a bunch of academic research to be able to watch what's happening to our democracy and see the paralysis right in Washington. And sadly, these elected officials are using, the people that we would expect to fix this problem are actually using the technology to get reelected and raise money and becoming more and more extreme in their viewpoints. And then lastly, and I'm sorry for the length of the answer, but my point here is that it's not any one moment. It was a series of learnings along a journey that brought me here. After selling the Dodgers and landing on my feet and having a great financial outcome there, I was able to help start a public policy school in Washington, D.C. with my alma mater, Georgetown University. Thinking that maybe we can create some policies here that will begin to rein in these monsters and so forth. And I learned very quickly that our policy making apparatus is no match for big tech. And it moves too quickly. It's too powerful. There's too much money. There's too much influence. And our current political environment and policy making apparatus are no match for this. We need to innovate our way forward. And that's what entrepreneurs do, right? We come up with inventions to solve problems. We don't wait for governments to solve them. We don't wait for regulators to solve them. And we do like free markets, by the way, right? So we want to actually be entrepreneurial about this. And at the heart of Project Liberty is an entrepreneur spirit.
Two things. One is you talk about it, and I'd love to understand this a little bit more from a structural perspective, that the issue really lies, or a lot of this, in the structure. Talking to someone like myself, not a builder or a technologist, or what do you mean in terms of that and how the internet was built? And then how you believe that from that, this is why there really is hope to change the landscape?
Yeah, so let me do a quick flyover in terms of how the internet works, and then we can talk a little bit about why there's hope. So back in the 70s, early 80s, there was technology, and this was coming out of the Cold War, by the way, and our government was extremely concerned about our centralized telecommunication system. Everything was going through AT&T at the time with these central communication hubs. We were highly vulnerable to a Soviet attack on those hubs, which would disable our communications. So the government wanted to have a decentralized communications system. So think of it, rather than line to line, connect one connection, and if you sever the line, you have no communication. Think of it as a spider web with many lines that connect you. So you can put a hole in a piece of the spider web, but you still would have connectivity because you'd have massive redundancy. So it was with the help of universities and smart computer scientists and technologists that this idea of creating this connection through computing devices was pursued. In 1983, there was an agreement by these folks to adopt a protocol, technically two protocols, but we refer to it now as one, TCP/IP, Transfer Control Protocol/Internet Protocol. So, and people may recognize IP, right? Because we have an IP address to this day,
right,
on the internet. We're not a person on the internet. We're a device. Keep that in mind, okay? This was designed for devices. So when these scientists and researchers and so forth all agreed to use this protocol, suddenly all these computing devices were connected and the spider web was created. And so we had the internet, and it was a pretty awesome invention and a very powerful thing. Now, remember, at that point in time, the people on the other, on each end of those devices were pretty well known to the other person. So this was an environment where it wasn't millions or billions of people connected. It was hundreds and thousands, and they all knew each other and the credentials that the other person had. So it was a trusted internet. In 1989, Tim Berners-Lee came up with an idea and another thin layer protocol called TP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, the protocol we're using for this call and that we all use now. And we adopted it because what did it do? It connected all of us and our data now to the internet. So now all this data is connected, regardless of what device it's on. And we now have this World Wide Web. And again, I emphasize, enabled by a simple thin layer protocol. That was, again, another awesome moment in the development of the internet. Very powerful idea. But then something happened, and something that I don't think was anticipated, or I don't think it made the inventors of the internet or the World Wide Web excited. And that is, we entered the app age. And the app age, and by apps, all the things we use, right? Facebook, Google, Amazon, et cetera, and all the other millions of apps out there, even though there are a few now that dominate massively the landscape. What happened with the app age is that a decentralized technology designed to connect all of us and to educate all of us and share information and just create opportunity and connectivity and a marketplace and all these wonderful things took a pivot. And it became a race to scrape the data, accumulate the data, aggregate the data, and call it one's own, and then figure out what to do with the data. So Facebook won the race for social media, Amazon for shopping media, Google for search media, et cetera. But they're all doing the same thing. They're scraping our social graphs, which is a mapping of our relationships and everything we do. And by the way, this is not just when we're actively online. We're always online now, 24/7, whether we like it or not. Whether we're on social media or searching or shopping or watching television or driving in our car or walking down a city street. The Internet of Things is everywhere. It's in our dishwashers, right? It's in our Nest cameras. It's in Alexa and Siri. And it's all about capturing information about us and hoarding it in a few places. And then those companies decide what to do with that data. What then happened is the companies decided that a great thing to do with it was to sell things and sell advertisements, to sell things. And the more they could accumulate data about us, target us, make judgments about not only what we might want to buy, but now we see they make judgments about our personalities and how we might react to news or react to information. So we're triggered, right? Our behaviors are triggered now because we're no longer human beings on the internet. We're just the product. We're viewed as bits and bytes, data that gets accumulated. We're just a number. We're just a device. And we've been totally dehumanized by this technology. And the companies have decided that it's more important to generate great wealth than it is to protect kids. It's more important to generate great wealth than it is to strengthen democracy. And this is, in my opinion, not right. It's just not right. And again, as I said earlier, I'm a capitalist. I think people are entitled to make as much money as they can, as long as they don't break the law or hurt kids or destroy democracy or destroy our life, right? What we have now is technology that is destroying everything we love. So what? So we can use the internet? It's a ridiculous trade-off. What we need is an internet that's designed in a way to optimize for people, not machines, right? We need another layer of another thin layer protocol. We call it DSNP, which, if adopted at scale, would turn the internet into one that, from one that connects devices to one that connects human beings, where we own and control our data and we decide what's done with that data. So imagine an internet where the new apps in the third generation of the internet are clicking on our terms of use for our data. We're not clicking on the terms of use of these big platforms and giving away everything about us. In the digital age, the information about us, let's think about it as our digital DNA, every bit as important as our biological DNA, which, by the way, has been digitized as well. Mm-hmm. And let's not think about it as this abstract thing called data. Let's think about it as our personhood. Everything we are in the digital age is revealed and captured by data that describes how we're made up, what we like, who we connect with, what our preferences are, predicts our behavior, and so on and so forth. It is our lived experience. Our biological DNA is what we're born with. Our digital DNA is what is our life, right? Now, which is captured. And everything we do online in this day and age is captured forever. That's very different, Robert, than when you and I grew up, when we could make a mistake and recover from it. Now, it's very hard to recover from mistakes, and for kids in particular. And all of this gets weaponed because there are a lot of people out there that, for whatever reason, they'll do harmful stuff to other people. But we need to minimize that, not have technology that maximizes that and makes that easy for people to do bad things. Shouldn't we have to be a person to be on the internet? Shouldn't we have to only be one person? Is it right for me to be able to pretend I'm you, which I can do now if I want to, or vice versa? Should I be able to be a machine bot that spits out all kinds of falsehoods, and your kids or my kids or you or I don't know what we're reading or seeing is true or false? Should we have deepfake videos? How does somebody know this is even me talking to you right now? It's not my voice that's been mimicked by artificial intelligence. Yeah. So we're about to enter the next phase of all this, generative AI, which, by the way, is the same technology in the hands of the same people, but it's more powerful. And wouldn't we want to fix something that's broken first before we let it be more powerful rather than just let it rip? I think so, for sure. And again, want to be clear, massively pro-technology. I think this technology can do incredible things for humanity, so much so that our kids won't hesitate in 10 years if we fix this when asked, will your life be better than your parents? Whereas they might say, no way. Now, in 10 years, they'll say, my life is going to be massively better than my parents because I'm going to live till I'm 150 years old and I'm going to be healthy, right? Because we now have technology working for people and solving problems, not ripping us apart.
More from our guests, but first, a word from our sponsors.
There is more to being a successful entrepreneur than just good business practices. What is it about an entrepreneur's childhood that helped them fuel their entrepreneurial spirit? What are entrepreneurs doing to cultivate this spirit in their own children and build a legacy beyond their business? Tune in each month to the Road to Why podcast by the Northern Trust Institute, where host Eric Chapaya dives deeper with leading entrepreneurs on these topics and more. Find the Road to Why where you listen to your favorite podcasts.
and our next sponsor.
Looking for a rewarding, life-changing opportunity that enhances the lives of children in your community? With almost 50 years of experience, Huntington Learning Center is the nation's leading K-12 tutoring and test prep franchise, dedicated to shaping brighter futures for our students and franchisees. Huntington is the top revenue-producing supplemental education franchise in the U.S., and our proven system is the key to success for you and your students. The Huntington Advantage includes low startup costs, turnkey systems, dedicated support teams, national and local marketing support, and multiple revenue streams to help you build a life-enriching and profitable business. No education experience is needed. In today's environment, the need for tutoring has never been greater. When you become part of Huntington Learning Center, you're filling an urgent need in the growing $5 billion supplemental education industry. To learn more, visit huntingtonfranchise.com. Make a meaningful difference. Pursue your dreams of business ownership and be a positive force in your community. Don't wait. Visit huntingtonfranchise.com today.
And we're back.
Great points, and I appreciate explaining this to me, as I would call myself a novice, and I think you do a great job, and I think I'm excited with your book coming out, which we'll talk about, because it sounds like you're able to explain it in a way, and I'm sure you did this when you wrote it, where someone like myself could understand this. The one thing I do want to ask you, though, which is really intriguing, is how do you get, or what is the roadmap that you have in mind where they were able to make that flip? These companies, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Meta, Twitter, whatever it's called now, X, they have this big head start. How do you start? How do you plan? How do you start with these apps that the data is being controlled by the individuals? And then I want to get into the AI, because you brought that up, and that's, but first I really want to understand this part and how you see the roadmap to make those changes.
I think at the core of this, we need to prove that there's an alternative to what we have that can be built and is as just as easy to use, just as polished and as the current user experience with the internet, right? Because it's pretty damn easy to scroll Instagram or send a text or a tweet or et cetera, et cetera. So we need to make sure that the next version of the internet is every bit as good and better in the user experience, and also better in, because it's, people are participating in the wealth that's created from the data that they're generating. So starts with the tech, which we have now created the protocol called DSMP. It's been released. It's open source. Nobody should own it, just like nobody should own HTTP. It is out in the world for everybody to use. It can go either to projectliberty.io or dsmp.org and learn about it. But the point is, people will be building apps on this new protocol, and it's at the top of the stack, the app layer, that most people will be entering this new world. Now, the first use case is a Web2 social media app by the name of MeWe, M-E-W-E. 20 million users. They are now migrating their users over to DSMP as we speak. There are some 650,000 people now who are being treated like people, not like devices, on the internet, who are owning and controlling their data and are on this new or evolved internet, right? When I say new, I want to be careful, because it's still built on TCP/IP and HTTP. It's just that now we have another social layer, which means a human layer of the internet, so that people can own and control their data and have agency. I would say in a matter of a month or two, there'll be 1 million. By the end of the year, hopefully 10 million, and so on and so forth. And each year it will be 10x. So that's at the core of the project, is we have to demonstrate that there's an alternative, because just physical human migration, two things are required before people migrate. Number one, they have to really be sick and tired of where they live. And number two, they need a place to go. So in digital migration, people need to be sick and tired of where they live, which more and more people seeing the harms now and seeing how they're being abused by the current tech architecture are saying, oh, I am sick and tired of where I'm living here. This is not a healthy place. This is a toxic environment and I'm being taken advantage of. But until we show them there's a place to go, then they, you know, people kind of stick. Lots of people live in places that are not the greatest if they don't have a place to go, right? So it's why I use the American Project as the kind of metaphor for the book, Our Biggest Fight, because that was a moment in time where people actually made a choice between being a subject of a monarchy versus a citizen of a self-regulated democracy. And so we can get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
The other point that you're making around, and I said earlier, I don't even see Project Liberty as a tech project. I see it as a civic project or a social project, is that we need to have conversations like the one we're having right now, where, and I'm really grateful for this, because you have an audience, right, that you can communicate with that might be experiencing some of the same issues with this technology that you and I are experiencing and wishing there was an alternative. And we need to let people know. We need to let people know there is an alternative. It's happening. They can be a part of it. And being a part of it, meaning they're a parent concerned about their kids and they want to learn more about this. So they go on MeWe and they start the journey to the new internet, or there's some other app that's being created. I will add that there's a dozen apps that are being created right now. And that's just the very beginning, because there needs to be millions of them. And people are going to start, maybe somebody's a young software genius is going to build a new company on this new protocol. That's what happened. It's all only taken 20 years for this landscape to totally change and for the app age to have begun. We need to move away from this centralized autocratic surveillance technology that we live with now and re-decentralize the internet and empower people over the platforms and give people ownership and control and the value that their data has. And so this new world we're about to move into of a data shared economy, I think is going to be just tremendous for people. But it starts with being aware of the problem and that there's a fix, right? So part of Project Liberty, it has got to be really part of this awakening. But thankfully, there are many people out there now talking about the problem and getting people, I think, to wake up. And that makes me hopeful, because you used that word earlier a lot, but should we be hopeful? And I think we should be hopeful for two or three reasons. One, we've demonstrated that we can fix the problem. There is a technical fix. And by the way, if someone else has a better fix than our idea, we'll support them. This isn't about whose idea is it. This is about fixing an engineering problem, an infrastructure problem, and doing it at the bottom of the stack. Number two, I'm hopeful because I see more and more people deeply concerned about the harms of the current architecture. And then three, I'm a huge believer in people and their creativity and their capacity to innovate and be entrepreneurial. That's what has made this country great. And that's what has inspired my family for generations. And I believe in people to do that. So I think right now we're doing the possible, and pretty soon we'll all be collectively doing the impossible.
I love how you talk about that and the next generation of entrepreneurs, because, and we spoke about this prior, just in terms of kids, our kids, and situations they're going through. I had a daughter that wrote the wrong thing, and it, you know, she wasn't allowed to go somewhere and do something, and she learned from that. And I am hoping what I really foresee now, where you've given me hope through this conversation, because when we first started talking, when I first started thinking about this, I'm like, how do you change this? But now when I understand what you're doing, and also understand that the next generation of entrepreneurs are probably going to entail a lot of people like my daughter, your daughter, others who have gone through this and want to change that. That gives me hope to understand that, you know what? Really smart engineers, really smart entrepreneurs are going to get behind it and want to make those changes and develop the right apps and products that people will start using. Now, I do want to ask you, because this is so relevant, and this to me has been the scariest thing. And you mentioned this just prior. We're talking about AI, and you had said something to the degree. Now, it's one thing 15 years ago, you're reading about yourself and it's awful, right? It's not truth, but you're reading about it on Facebook or in the news or whatever it might be. But you mentioned and talking about AI, and I'm excited about AI because I'm like you. I believe that there's so much positive. But you said, right now, I could be saying, you know what? This is Frank McCourt. You know what? I'm doing an interview with Frank McCourt. The AI has the ability, the capabilities now, multiple companies, to take your voice and to recreate and put an interview out there. And people are like, yeah, that sounds like Frank. That sounds like Robert. And it could be complete misinformation. That scares me. How do you look at, with what you're doing initially with everything is a tall task, how do you look at AI?
Yeah. So, and by the way, it's also the example you used about how does somebody know it's really me or you, right, in this conversation. It also allows bad actors to actually say or do bad things. And then when they're caught, say, oh, that wasn't me. That's a fake. And if we're living in a world where there's no set of shared facts and there's no reality, we are not governable, right? Because we're all entitled to our own opinion, obviously, but we're not all entitled to our own set of facts. That's not how the world has worked up to this time. We need to all agree that this is the closest thing to a set of facts that we have at the moment. Obviously, the more we learn about the world and each other, sometimes those facts evolve. But if we're in a world where we were still arguing about whether the world was round or flat, and both sides were like at war with each other, we wouldn't have made much progress, right? We'd be stuck in that argument. And that's essentially where we are now. So this is really vitally important. And so what we need, I believe, is an intranet where I mentioned earlier, you need to be a person. You need to have identity. You need to be able to, doesn't mean you're going to share everything about yourself. You're going to maybe just share the minimum you need to share, okay, in order to engage with something. If in the world we've come from, somebody needs to prove they're 18 years old and they show a driver's license, they're also showing where they live, the color of their hair, how tall they are, and the date of birth. And all they need to show is that they're 18 years old. That's the only piece of information. So in a new internet, we'll be able to show the minimum we want to show, a immutable fact that the person is 18 without sharing all the other information, which is unnecessary to proving that you're 18. So verification, attestation, identity are all things now that technology can deliver. And these were technologies that were not available in 1989 when the World Wide Web was created. Well, they're available now, so let's incorporate them. And by the way, one of the really important ones would be provenance of data, right? If you want to prove that something is an original, it's difficult to impossible right now in the digital world, because unlike a photocopy or some copy of somebody tries to fake an artwork, right? And some talented painter paints it, and then people, experts come and say, that's a fake. It's not the original, because they can, different ways of judging when was it painted and the age of the canvas or the age of the paint, or they didn't make paint like that back in that era. You can tell a copy from an original. In the digital world, you cannot tell a digital copy from a digital original currently, because it's identical. The millionth copy on a photocopier is very different than the first copy on a photocopier, right? It degrades. It might be slightly from copy to copy, but it degrades. The millionth copy of a digital copy is identical to the original, okay? Very problematic. So shouldn't we have a way to determine what was the original? That was an original video that Frank did with Robert, or original audio, or that's an original picture taken of something that happened in Ukraine or the Middle East, rather than a doctored photo or video. And we have that technology now. And by the way, if we're going to move into the age of generative AI or large language models, which are essentially, as I said, the same technology we have now, predictive technology, predictive algorithms, but with much bigger data sets and requiring much bigger compute power, don't we want to know whose data is going in? And if it's very valuable data that you happen to have created, should you be entitled to have A, say whether yes, you give permission for that data to go into that large language model or not? And if you give permission, on what terms? To say, you can use my data in your large language model, but that's my life's work and I'd like to get paid for it. Not, you just can't steal it because your machines ingest it all. Right now, without intervention, all of human creativity, all of it, and the bulk of it is happening right now online around the world, right? This is where data is being created. At more data will be created today than was created from the beginning of civilization into the early 2000s. That's the data that's being scraped. That's the data that's being trained. That's the data that's in these large language models. Don't we want to know what is verifiable data, where it came from, who owned it, and give the people that created it some of the value? That's the New York Times lawsuit right now around copyright, right? We, as I said earlier, we have an internet that is incredibly powerful in terms of connecting people all over the globe and doing amazing things. You can go online and order something and it's delivered to your doorstep tomorrow. You can go online, search something, get all kinds of information. You can communicate with anybody around the world. So fantastic. But shouldn't it be done in a way that it actually respects people? And with that data and those communications and those shopping excursions or search excursions aren't scraped up by some platform, and then their algorithms make judgments about us, and then suddenly we're targeted with ads to buy this or do this, or triggered, we're fed a news feed that gets us to go down some rabbit hole or this or that. Shouldn't we be in control here as individuals and decide how our data is used and for what purpose? And if it's a common good purpose, like curing a disease, I'm sure millions of people would be happy to let their data be used anonymously. If it's a commercial purpose, however, that somebody's going to make trillions of dollars, I think we probably want to participate in that. It just stands to reason. I think we need to get back to the basics here and treat this as a human rights issue and a property rights issue. We need to return ownership and control of data, i.e. agency and choice, to individuals, and the value proposition needs to change. That's the American way. That's what's made this country great, right? My forebears left a place where they had no rights. They could not own anything. They came to Boston. They started a company. They took a risk, and they were happy to be in a place where they were born with unalienable. I was born with unalienable rights. I had the same rights as any king or queen, right? When I was born, as were you. That was revolutionary. In my opinion, sadly, we are moving in the opposite direction. As fast as the technology is moving forward, we are getting our rights stripped from us. We are now becoming subjects again. And the rulers now are not men and women with big gowns and crowns. They're five big companies. And they should not control my life. I want to own me. I don't want them to own me. And I feel most people, once they understand this, will share my perspective.
I agree with you, because prior to this conversation, and having this conversation has been fascinating and just incredible what I've learned, and really what you've dove into and are trying to make a change. Thankfully, that's what your mom taught you. Don't just talk about it, and you're doing it. And before I let you go, I want to ask you about the book, because I love the fact you said this really is, when we think about it, when how this great country started with the Revolutionary War, and we didn't want to live in those circumstances. It really is fascinating, because when you discuss this today and talk about this, we're really going or falling back down that path, and it has to change. So can you just talk a little bit about the book and what you dive into and just really, as you said, how you came up with the title? Because I do agree with you. I think it's that important.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. I'm really appreciative that I was given the opportunity to write this book and that Crown Publishing took it on. And one little data point that might underscore the importance of the set of issues we're talking about. This is the fastest book from idea to the bookshelves and bookstores in the history of Crown. And this was done in record time. And it's because they understand the urgency of this problem and the timeliness of it. So I tip my cap to David Drake and Paul Whitlatch and everybody at Crown Publishing. The book is called Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Dignity, and Humanity in the Digital Era. And this is very reminiscent, at least to me, of what was going on in 1775, pre the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Thomas Paine wrote a pamphlet called Common Sense, and he took what was a complicated issue and a quote, impossible thing, end quote, and reduced it to writing. And he made it very simple for his fellow settlers in what preceded the United States of America. He said, we have a choice. We can remain subjects of a monarchy, or we can be citizens. And what he meant by citizens is we're all created equal. We're all created as equals. We're born with unalienable rights. Those rights should be protected by a government we form of, by, and for the people. And by the way, for those rights to matter, we need to respect those rights in others, the so-called social contract. So he wrote that pamphlet, and roughly 500,000 copies were printed and distributed in a total population of 2.5 million people. It was a powerful, you might call it the bestseller of all time. Hmm. And he got people thinking about something which would have been impossible for them to imagine if he hadn't put it forward for people to imagine. Now, of course, looking back 250 years later, we're pretty darn happy that he put that forward and that his fellow settlers at the time chose citizenship and self-governance rather than continuing to be subject to a monarchy. And in that monarchy, the British Empire was the most powerful monarchy of the time. So some people might have said, I'm part of a powerful monarchy. I'm going to stay there. Just like big tech right now is the most powerful technology, and these are the richest, most powerful companies ever created. This is an empire, just like the British Empire was. And some people may say, I'm happy to be a subject to those feudal lords, these new feudal lords, the people that run these companies. Or, like in the era of Thomas Paine, some other people might say, what he says makes a lot of sense. Why wouldn't I be born with the same rights? Why should I be born and to be somebody else was born to a family that they're ordained for life to rule me? That doesn't seem fair or right. This was all radical, but for people that lived for generations under the rule of a royal family, that's all they knew. And it took someone to actually say, there is another way forward. It doesn't have to be this way. And he put it in plain and simple language and put the power to the people to make up their own mind. They had a choice, and it was up to them to decide. And as I say, thankfully, they made the choice they made, and the United States of America was created, and what followed Common Sense was the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And all of this set of rights and these values and principles and ideals that we then built the most amazing country ever on top of. Why in the world would we ever give up all those rights so we can use the internet? To me, it makes no sense. Why should we, in our pre-internet lives, fight for those rights, protect those rights, export those rights to other countries that want to have a piece of what America has. And now we're giving up those rights. We're letting a few companies surveil us 24/7, scrape our data, know everything about us and exploit it. That's a human rights violation. This is a human rights issue. This is not about data. This is about us as human beings. If I worked for the government and I ran the Postal Service and I went into your house in 1989 when a stamp was 24 cents, when the World Wide Web was created, and said, I'm going to deliver your mail for free, you might say, that sounds good. Yeah, that's better than 24 cents per stamp. But by the way, I'm going to put a camera in every room of your house, in your office and your car and your this or that. You say, well, that doesn't feel very good to me. Oh, by the way, yeah, but it is for free. The mail, you are getting the 24 cent stamp. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to open your mail and read everything in it. And, but it's for free, right? The no stamp, no 24 cents. And by the way, if I learn anything when I read the mail of any good business idea or anything, that's my information now. I can do whatever I want with it and I can steal that idea. Oh, and by the way, if your young daughter she's struggling with her weight, I've got an idea for her. I'm going to feed her stuff so she can become even more anxious, but you are getting free stamps. So pretty good deal, right? And we'd all say you're out of your mind and we wouldn't let the government do it. Why the heck are we going to why are we letting five companies do it? Why are we doing this? It doesn't have to be this way. We can fix this. And the operative word here is we. I can't fix this, but we can. And this is what Project Liberty is. And this is what I hope the book does, is it just gives people, I hope it's a call to action. Gives people some information that they might not have now. Gives them a way to plug in. And they can go to ourbiggestfight.com and be part of this fight and be part of this team. And let's get it right this time.
Yeah, I will say thank you so much for coming on. We definitely need our Boston Tea Party moment to really get out there. And I think with the book coming out and putting it into hopefully more of common sense, as like you talked about Thomas Paine, where people can really understand, because it is being talked about amongst parents, amongst others. And now is the time. And I just want to thank you for coming on. And I cannot wait to read the book. And I want to ask you, not off topic, but one last question before I let you go, because there's very few people who get this opportunity. I assume growing up in Boston, you were a diehard Red Sox fan.
My grandfather had the privilege of being a part owner of the Boston Braves. And what we're most proud about was that the Boston Braves started something called the Jimmy Fund, which is the most successful sports philanthropic partnership in history. And it's created Dana-Farber Cancer Research Institute, the hospital in Boston, which does unbelievably great work. But the Braves left Boston in 1953, which was the year I was born. I grew up a diehard Red Sox fan and just lived and died with the Sox and raised my family in the same manner. So they were all Sox fans growing up. And yeah, so for sure, big Sox fan.
This is my question, because only a few people get the opportunity to answer this. You then buy the Los Angeles Dodgers. You become owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers. What happens in that situation? Now, I know one's an American League team, one's a National League team, but regardless, are you able to give up that, the fan, in the from a kid and the heart, and especially at those points, going through the heartbreak and the years of Yastrzemski and the one game, the Bucky Dent game, and living through that, and then owning the Dodgers. How do you do you become a Dodger fan? Do you become, like, how does that work?
First of all, you've triggered something else, which I lived with and through emotionally with that impossible dream team. And it's interesting when you put it in terms of, when I think about it now as a kid, in that impossible dream, right, for the Red Sox, and how it captured the imagination of New England and lifted that team and what was done. And it's a bit like the inspiration that we hope occurs for Project Liberty, isn't it? Where when you lift people up and they're part of that project and you've captured their imagination incredible things happen. And that was really what catapulted the Sox into the imagination of the entire nation. On your question about loyalties and how do you manage the dual loyalties and so on and so forth, I had the privilege of bidding on the Sox, and then MLB had a different plan where they were going to buy the Montreal Expos, and the owner of the Expos is going to buy the Marlins, and the owner of the Marlins is going to buy the Sox, and then MLB was going to sell the Expos to a new owner someday in Washington, and that became the Washington Nationals. So it was complicated internal politics, but I understood it all. I was just thought it was such a great privilege to have even the chance to bid on my hometown team. And I remember going to New York to Park Avenue to visit with MLB and just to make sure that I hadn't stepped on anybody's toes or poked anybody in the eye, because sports and politics in Boston get pretty, there can be elbows flying. And they were the ones that said to me, no, to the contrary, would you be interested in buying another team? And that was the first time I ever thought about buying another team. And as I looked at the landscape and saw that the Dodgers were, that Rupert Murdoch was interested in selling the Dodgers, I fell in love with the idea. And my rationale was this. They were National League, not American League, and both the Dodgers and the Red Sox hate the Yankees. So, I said I was on solid ground. And kidding aside, the Dodgers the Sox have an incredible history, and not just in baseball, but in just the American story, yeah. Jackie Robinson, and so on and so forth. And I got to tell you, Robert, I cannot tell you how proud I was when I brought my Dodgers into Fenway Park to play against the Red Sox. And it was almost a surreal moment as a kid growing up in Boston, never imagining looking for the cheapest ticket to a Sox game and then bringing the Dodgers to Fenway. And the last point I'll make, when you own a team, you have no dual loyalties. You're all in. And I wanted to, for those three games and that three game series, I wanted to win every game and just try to crush them. And it was just one thing about being a steward of a professional sports franchise, I think to do it correctly, you have to be all in and really a fan of the sport. And really, you can't be compromised in any way, shape, or form. But I look at it all as just having been one of the privileges of my life that nearly a decade out in LA with the Dodgers. And I'm really happy with the choice I made in selling it and to whom I sold it to and the job that they're doing. And imagine this, when I bought the Dodgers, 2004, they had not won a postseason game in 16 years.
Wow. I didn't even realize that they have helped start it, turned it around. It's amazing.
Yeah, so they were able to win that first postseason game in our first year and then back-to-back NLCSs in 08 and 09. And that was the first time it had happened in over 30 years. And then rebuild the farm system and renovate the stadium, new spring training facility, and get the winning ways back. But you know what? At the end of the day, when we took that shiny object off the mantle and put the shine back on it, didn't take long, because it's a great franchise with a huge tradition and loyal fan base. And it's great to see what they're doing now. And I'm not sure they're going to lose a game this year.
They are stacked. But Frank, thank you so much. This has been inspiring. As I said, Project Liberty and what you are doing, this really is when I truly believe the battle, at least in our lifetimes, and I can't think of anything else that is as important, especially seeing it in real time from the beginning of the internet, and let's say in the late 80s, and now seeing the impact on my children and on myself, and AI is the rage and the things that could happen. Now is the time, and I'm glad that with your book, Crown moved it through, and I'm glad they understand that the time is now, not to go back to the Revolutionary War, but to take up arms and really change this, because it's scary to think what could happen. And you made your point extremely well in this conversation, and I am sure and I hope a good portion of our population reads your book.
I appreciate you that you're saying that, Robert. And it'll be available on March 12th. And as I said, it's called Our Biggest Fight, not My Biggest Fight. So you're part of the fight now too. And that's the point. And I hope your listeners understand that this could be their fight too. And I think it's exciting to have a project we all can work on together. And I remember when Kennedy said, we're all going to go to the moon and we're going to do it, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And like you, I know exactly where I was when that happened. And this is we all went to the moon together, and that he took us from something that was a big stretch. But look what that did for this country and its morale and its view in the world. And by the way, it's the same technology that was created in order to land a man on the moon is now what's used in smartphones and GPS and all the other stuff. So it does have all these other benefits. Yeah. Now that we know what the internet is capable of and how it works, let's fix it. It's very doable. And then it works as a force of good change. And America can lead the way here again.
You made me a believer, and thankfully for your mom, who taught you that go out and do it. You've gone out and you're doing it. And like you said, with the book coming out March 12th, it is our fight, right? And hopefully a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this podcast, others, it's time to get involved. It really is the way I look at it and see it. And I'm just thankful that you've taken up this initiative, and thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for your interest, and I hope you make it your fight too, Rob.
I will.
Thank you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.